everybody, and welcome to Fortress Comic News, episode 259. I am one of your hosts, Chris, alongside the master of the class, Mike.
Whatever class that is. I don't know. That's sad if that's what I am, because that's really low on the totem pole here. What's up? It's I don't know, what is it, April now? We got through April Fool's Day. We got, no joke, we have two guests on the show today. Colin Kelly, Jackson Lanzig. They actually, when they write together, they do a thing like Gogeta in Dragon Ball Z. They do like the fusion. They do the earrings. They put on earrings. It fuses them together and they write comics. So we'll talk about that.
They become me with talent and they write comics.
Yeah. Whatever, they just listen to whatever Chris wants to read and they make it good.
Yeah.
What else is going on? Watch anything interesting? See anything?
Yeah, I watched quite a bit this week. So there's not a whole lot of news. And actually, I think there's no news in the TV and movie space. So we can just jump right into what we're watching, I guess. But
well, I got, so I got
the master.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, you got the flash facts this week?
Yeah, I'm going to do the flash facts at the start of the show because I did them at the end of the show because I forgot last week.
Okay.
So, Pat's flash facts, and there's a disclaimer for this one. He said it was a painful one to watch, so...
like most episodes of The Flash.
he really wishes that he never kept watching after the true ending in the Hall of Justice. I mean, I don't know what he's watching because that's where it ended.
It's my lot in life. Nobody listens to me.
B story. Yeah, exactly. B story. Iris goes to Coast City. Why they're still doing B stories with Iris, who knows? She goes to investigate a story about the Coast City Phantom. There she meets Tina Wazo, Phantom Girl, and wants to help her learn how to use the powers. There's a C story. Oh, God. Iris has been suffering from time sickness, starts to forget days at a time. That's just the life of a stoner, to be honest.
I was going to say, that sounds like the COVID era, but okay.
Yeah. Can't remember shit.
Don't know what day it is. Time has no meaning.
Yeah. Honestly, I would rather have that than Iris calling the shots for Team Flash, because she's not very qualified to do those things. None of them are, really. I think we won't get into that. Cisco is probably the only qualified one. Okay, it's A story. There's another burn victim in Central City, and Barry's able to capture a sample of the flame. Okay.
Wonder who it is.
The flame gets loose in Star Labs, and Chester believes the flame... I forget who Chester is. He believes the flame to be the ghost of his father. The flame starts to burn Star Labs, and the team figured out the flame feeds off grief. Okay. The flame takes the form of Chester's father's, feeding off Chester's grief. Chester overcomes the grief. The flame disappears. The team thought they were looking for a meta with fire abilities. Turns out the flame is just some sort of creature itself. So they're fighting. They're fighting fire.
My brain hurts.
Fire creature. Can't make this shit up.
You had the perfect ending, CW.
Yeah. I mean, like, the Flash lightsaber thing from a couple seasons ago sounded cool, but, like, there's not much else you can do to pique my interest here. And a flame villain.
Let's move into something positive, because I have a lot of negative to say, and I want to talk about something positive for a second.
All right, Moon Knight Episode 1. Did you watch it?
I did.
Okay, and I haven't watched it yet, but you go ahead, just spoil the shit out of it. Do what you gotta do.
So, I really like this episode. It reminds me a little bit of Memento. Was it? Yeah, Memento.
Yeah, with Christopher Nolan's like first movie, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In as much as it was trying to display his illness through a visual medium, so we get kind of he's referred to as the loser in terms of the personalities. That's Khonshu kind of being a dick, but basically he's our main character for the first episode, and we get like where chunks of time are missing. Mm-hmm. And he's doing all these things because he doesn't know if he's hallucinating or if he's crazy or what's going on. But like, he goes through this process of like putting tape on his door and like putting all the locks on, all this stuff to mm-hmm. keep himself from like sleepwalking, is what he assumes. Is what okay. I assumed he assumes. Yeah. And we know he has split personality. So they do this thing where you only see his side of everything. So he'll wake up and just like be in this situation and he doesn't know where the fuck he is or what he's doing.
Okay.
And that happens throughout the episode. And it's really well done. It sets up our villain, kind of sets up that he has some sort of powers. And then the episode ends with, and Khonshu jumps in throughout the episode. And it ends with Khonshu being like, just, you know, let the better version of you out. And that's when he kind of looks in a mirror and sees that version talking to him. He's like, if you let me take control, I can fix everything. Mm. And, that's when we see Moon Knight kind of appear and it cuts. Okay.
So it was the costume on.
Yeah. So the costume we saw where it's like the mummified version of him.
Yeah.
You know, that one, that's the one we get.
Okay.
There's some supernatural elements. There's like a fucking Egyptian mummy dog creature thing that chases after him and all this weird stuff. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it did a really great job of like displaying his illness. And and that's why I kind of get like a Memento vibe where it's mm-hmm. not exactly done in that same vein of like the same illness, but it's done in the same vein of it did a great job of like showing that disease visually through mm-hmm. the story.
Yeah.
So I really liked it. Yeah.
Any action?
Not a whole lot of superhero stuff.
No fight scenes?
There's like two fight scenes, but because of how they did it to display the illness, they happen off camera. So like one, he just wakes up and he's just surrounded by like people who were beat to shit. And he wakes up like, where am I? What happened?
Yeah.
And then the other one is the dog. And that's when he transforms into Moon Knight and he's about to fight it. And it cuts to the credits.
Roll so, credits, son of a bitch.
Not a whole lot of action, but still just a really great episode.
Awesome. Yeah. That sounds really cool.
Not really TV, but I just want to mention it. I don't know if you heard about this Alan Moore masterclass he's doing with BBC.
I did see that. He's doing something. Yeah. Very interesting.
So it's, you know, those like, you hear them on podcasts all the time mm-hmm. that like, not on ours because they don't like us, but they advertise like these masterclasses, like learn from the masters and blah, blah. Yeah. So it's like I think it was $80 for the class. It's 6 hours of Alan Moore sitting down and like talking about writing. And doing like almost like a guest lecture kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I paid for it. And funny side note, my bank called me and was like, we just shut off your card because we're pretty sure this isn't you. I was like, no, that was me.
That was definitely me. They're like, nobody would pay for this.
Especially not you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I watched, like, about an hour of it, which is, like, the first three courses, I believe. And mm-hmm. it's really good. So, Alan Moore, a lot of people hate him because a lot of his, like, a lot of things you've heard about him are done through the written word. And mm-hmm. he's got this very dry, like, sarcastic sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And when he talks, it's just, there's moments where I'm literally just laughing because I'm like, the way he says it and the way he verbalizes himself, it's much better to hear him talk for himself than to read it. Like sometimes what he says doesn't come off well in print. Mm-hmm. Like there's a joke, I put it on Twitter this morning, but there's a joke that I just loved where he's talking about when he got Swamp Thing and he's like, well, my first question was, what's the swamp that he's the thing of? I'm like, that's a good joke. I like that. obviously not for anybody, but you know, it's 6 hours of Alan Moore teaching writing. Like I figured I'd at least give it a shot, see what it's all about. So okay, I'm really enjoying that.
I guess I thought it was going to be on some streaming service, but you actually have to pay separately for it.
Yeah. It's, you pay for the course. I don't know. Okay. It's BBC Maestro, which I live in America. We don't do BBC stuff. So I don't know if there's like a thing where you can pay to get whatever you want off of it.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is I'm like, Alan Moore talking about writing. Like, I got to see what this is about.
Yeah. I've seen the masterclass on Netflix for like British Bake Off where the hosts like talk about baking, like a technical way, which I think is pretty cool. So they do a lot of different stuff. Yeah, I saw like advertisements for it on like streaming services, and he's like, you know, doing pictures and stuff. I'm like, man, where, like, Alan Moore came out of hiding to do this? Kind of interesting.
Yeah, and there's, so one of the first things he talks about, he's like, when I thought about doing this, I was like, nah, what could I offer? But then he's like, but, you know, I've been writing for over 40 years professionally, and I figure there's got to be like one or two things that I could depart upon you. I'm like, so he's just got this like really dry wit to him that I just like. Yeah, so
that's funny.
And as somebody who, you know, writes for fun, it, you know, why not? And then I also watched the first episode of Halo.
Yeah. So how awesome was that dumpster fire that I've been hearing about?
So I'll say this, like 85% of it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
But the 15% that isn't ruins it.
Yeah, really?
It's so the first like 3/4 of the episode is basically a war thing. Like, so you're on this planet, there's these people, and they hate the Marines and the Spartans.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Covenant arrive and they start killing off people, and it's brutal. Like, when the Covenant shoot people, like, limbs just like disintegrate and they're left with like just husks. It's pretty brutal in how they did it. And then the chief and his crew show up and they save them. And then they're like, oh, I guess the Spartans aren't so bad. Mm-hmm. So that sequence was cool. There was, did you ever watch the Doom movie with The Rock?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You remember the sequence where they went in the first person? Because
yeah, it was awful.
Yeah, so they try to do that a few times, which I'm just like, don't do it.
No,
it doesn't
work. No.
So they go into like Chief's HUD like real quick. It's not like a long sequence, but they do it like a few times. So that kind of sucked, but for the most part, really good. And then it gets to the end where we get kind of why, what Chief's doing. He's trying to save this girl, blah, blah. So he goes against everybody. And this is what ruins it for me is as soon as they get into their ship and they sit down, he takes the helmet off and we gotta see the actor's face.
Yeah. And he doesn't have the same chief voice, right?
No, because they've hired an actor to play John. And it's like, this is what bugs me is Chief is a very like one note action hero.
Right.
He has relationship with like Cortana and other things, but for the most part, like shoot bad guy, be good guy. That's what Chief is.
Right.
So you could have done this without the actor, paid the voice actor so it sounded right. Because they did other things like the energy short sword, the sound effect is straight from the game, like a bunch of stuff is straight from the game. But they had to take the fucking helmet off, and that just ruined it for me.
And
I might keep watching it, but it just ruined it.
I saw the whole thing where it was like we had to take the helmet off, and it was like, have you not watched The Mandalorian?
Like, or Dredd.
Like Dredd.
We literally we went through this where Judge Dredd was Sylvester Stallone. We got to take the helmet off so he could scream, I am the law.
Yeah,
and then we did the good Dredd movie where he never took the helmet off. And I thought we learned a lesson, but apparently we didn't.
Well, and also the showrunners never played the Halo games.
Which I'm fine with. Like, that's...
Yeah, I don't know. If you don't, or at least if you don't like deep dive into it of like, what are the best things about it? Yeah. The best thing is Master Chief never takes his helmet off for like what, 6 or 7 Halo games?
I think even if the showrunners never watch it, like that's not a huge deal. But then like you should have some people that are not necessarily fans, but like the writers should probably play through the games or something. Or have somebody on staff from like old Bungie or 315 or 314 to like talk about this is what makes the story in the game good.
Right.
As opposed to just having nobody that's played it and be like, okay, so he's a big dude who shoots guns and we'll take his helmet off because you got to feel for the protagonist. I'm like, I really don't.
Yeah. It's like, this is a Halo show. This isn't supposed to be the next, like, you know, amazing tragedy.
No.
You're not trying to win an Academy Award.
You're supposed to connect with Cortana. So introduce Cortana and connect with that character through the affection that her and John have. But, you know, what do I know? I do a podcast in my basement.
What do I know? Yeah, I don't know. I heard about that. I didn't even watch it. Another thing I didn't even watch. Did you watch Morbius?
I did.
Oh no. Okay, let's hear the review. Spoilers for Morbius. I know nobody's going to see it, so give us the details.
Don't see it. it's bad. So it does the same. It makes the same mistakes that the first Venom movie made. And I know I said like Venom was pleasantly surprising.
Yeah,
but it's still not a good movie.
Right.
And this runs into the same problems. We have Morbius, so who's he going to fight? A different Morbius.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was a bad vampire movie that wanted a hero's arc. And at the end of the day, it achieved nothing, in my opinion. And then it made it even worse by having two after credit sequences, which I'm also going to ruin the hell out of everybody. So, first of all, the other vampire that he fights is his best friend, who is also, like, some guy from Doctor Who. And,
it's Matt Smith, right?
I think? Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And he has they also have a sequence straight out of Spider-Man 3, where Matt Smith, like, starts to realize, because they have this disease, I forget the name of the disease, I'm sorry, everybody, but they have this disease that, like, cripples their muscles and slowly kills them.
Okay.
And when Matt Smith gets the injection, he starts to be like, I'm normal. And then he has like this whole dance sequence where he puts on a suit and he's like, look at me, I'm fancy. And it's like, this is stupid. Nobody wants to see this.
Yeah, right.
And then they had to add at the end of the movie a she vampire for the next movie because, you know, we did that in Venom and it worked. So all that bullshit aside, the end credits was so you remember from Spider-Man No Way Home, the whole rift opening up and the multiverse and blah, blah, blah. So we saw that, and then we saw Michael Keaton, Vulture, and he gets transported over to the Morbius / Venom. We'll just call it the Sonyverse. And it cuts away. Then we have a second one where Vulture is now in his full suit from the MCU, finds Morbius, and is like, we should team up. And even my friends who aren't really big comic fans, just like kind of watch the Marvel movies and shit, we're both just like, that's not how this works. Like, Michael Keaton's from the MCU, so he shouldn't have transported over to this one.
Right.
And then they both looked at me and were like, and how do you get a suit from the MCU? Because that suit was made out of stuff from the Avengers movie, which didn't happen in this universe.
Right. Yeah, because he was grabbing scraps from the first Avengers movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. What the hell is going on? What are they doing?
It's a disaster. Like, nobody should go see this movie. Let me take the pain of the Sony movies for you all. And just know that you don't need to go see these movies.
We appreciate that. And I like, it's so sad to me because this is like the closest we'll ever get to a Man-Bat movie. that would have, they like ruined that, so I don't know.
Listen, I watched the 1990s hit movie Captain America like days before I watched this movie. We talked about it last week, and that movie was better than Morbius, and it has Italian Nazis and an Italian Red Skull.
It's crazy to me. And like Jared Leto's been making some hot garbage movies, lately.
Dude, if you do want some positivity in your life around this movie, there's a interview he does with some VTuber, which I just recently discovered what a VTuber is.
Yeah,
apparently it's just somebody that does anime voice with an anime like model.
Oh yeah, that's very strange. I don't even want to get into it here because I don't want to make judgments.
And this VTuber, I'm assuming it's a woman because the avatar is a woman, interviews Jared Leto, and it's just phenomenally awful because he's so awkward and he doesn't know what to do. So just watch that, and that's a better time than you'll have in the 2 hours you would watch Morbius.
I kind of was making judgments on that in the workplace, and someone kind of said that they were fans of that stuff, so I had to like put my foot in my mouth. And that's the last time I'll insult things that I don't understand. But it's weird. Anyways, it's weird.
It's whatever. It's not for me, and it's if I'm Jared Leto, I would look at my publicist and be like, why the fuck did I just do that?
Yeah, what did you do to me?
Because now you made me a meme online.
Right, yeah, because now, yeah, that's like insulting to him. Okay, let's get to this interview with Jackson Lanzig and Colin Kelly, and we'll see everybody on the other side.
Today's episode is brought to you by Zencastr. Zencastr is my favorite tool in my podcasting tool belt. Ever since we got Zencastr, it's just made everything easier, more streamlined. It's simpler to bring in guests and have them come and talk on the show. It makes the post-production for the show so much easier. And just everything. Simpler, faster, better. Our videos have looked better. Our audio has been better. Everything. Just phenomenal. It's if you're doing a podcast or you're thinking about doing a podcast, seriously, Zencastr is the first thing right after you buy the microphone to grab as part of your tool belt. It's just a phenomenal tool. So if you want to do that, everybody go to Zencastr.com and use the promo code Fortress of Comic News and you will get 30% off. Once again, that's Zencastr.com. Use the promo code Fortress of Comic News, or you can use my link zen.ai/Fortress Comic News. Those are also all in the show notes. If you forget partway through the show, they're right there for you. But seriously, check it out. 30% off. You can't miss. Trust me. All right, everybody. As we tease, we don't have just one special guest for you this week. We have two very special guests for you this week. Everybody, welcome back, Jackson Lanzig. And welcome for the first time, Colin Kelly. Welcome, guys.
Hey. Awesome to be back. Yeah. I was going to be like one special guest, one not so special guest, but I was.
Don't pit us against each other that early, man. We'll do that on our own. Trust me. Yeah.
You decide which is which, everybody.
Yeah. I also want to title this episode, "We Got Some Fucking Deadlines." So I want to put that in the header. We have some fucking deadlines. So welcome, guys. Jackson's been here before. Colin has not. So. We'll be gentle. And we know you have a bunch of swords behind you, so we won't take it too far. Okay, so let's hear the origin story from your side, Colin, because we got a lot of shit to talk about. So how did it start for you with the comics industry and then this whole relationship of you guys writing with each other?
Yeah, for sure. I was growing up, in love with the library, like so many of us. And the best part of the library is always going to be the graphic novel section. Early 90s, you had the weirdest eclectic assortment of things. So you're just kind of grabbing whatever you could pick up off the shelves. And then one day my mom comes home and she says, we're going to buy some magazines from, Girl Scouts or whatever. And in those magazine subscriptions were like three comic books you could pick up. So I lose my fucking head. And really? One of those books was Captain America. So I say, yes, please. I would like a folded up, stuffed into my mailbox.
Rolled up. Yeah.
Just like brutally savage. Yeah. But that's kind of where I got started. Just reading the weirdest kind of stuff from the library, and then also these wonderful Captain America comics, which in hindsight, it's the entire run of losing his powers and having to wear the Iron Man suit, and maybe not the not the cream of the crop kind of stuff, but definitely enough to kind of get my juices flowing and really fall in love with the medium.
For sure.
As for this guy, we met in college. We were both USC cinema students, going to USC on massive scholarships because we're both poor as dirt. And effectively,
thumbs up for that. Poor
scholarship for student loans that I finally paid off this year. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank
you.
One of them all. So hence there you go. Why we have all these fucking deadlines.
Yeah.
We met in film school. I went away for an amazingly wet and cold summer abroad in Ireland and came back to find that my best friend had found a new best friend with this gentleman, Jackson Lansing, here. So, of course, I instantly hated him because that was my spot and my best friend. Yeah. Shout out David Server, wherever you are. And pretty much spent the next year really despising this guy. Partially that was because we fit very similar verticals. We were both very clever, outspoken, storytellers, effectively. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I crashed so hard against Jackson was he's fucking good, right? Like, it's easy to have peers when you're like, look, you're really talented, but we all know who's the best.
Yeah,
do that as easily with Jack. So we kind of started developing. We ended up in a writer's group together. And suddenly I'm reading his stuff. And I'm, once again, it's kind of driving deeper into my skin that this is a guy who really specializes in small stories, black box stories. Is this sounding familiar? Mm-hmm. What I didn't realize at the time is that he was looking at my stuff and saying, holy shit, I didn't know you could do this. The USC screenwriting program is really great, really well known for saying, don't worry about budget, write what you love, which is a good way to encourage you to get writing and a bad way to learn how to write scripts that actually can sell.
Right.
But, I'm writing $400 million action extravaganzas. Jackson's writing these tight little black box character dramas.
Because I wasn't in the screenwriting program. I was in the directing program. So I needed to write stuff that I could direct.
You knew about the budgets.
Exactly.
What's a budget? Never met
him. Yeah, right.
And slowly through that, we kind of started to develop a mutual respect. Because how can you hate someone that talented?
Right.
We start going to comic book stores together every Wednesday. We pile into David's PT Cruiser and drive up to Golden Apple. Eat the greasiest pizza on the planet. And pick up our books and then spend the next few hours arguing about our books and really kind of creating a shared storytelling language through that clash, lovingly good-natured clash. After school, we picked up some tickets. Our parents kind of chipped in to be able to pay for gas and tickets for us to drive out to Lollapalooza in Chicago, which is still one of the greatest lineups ever. Rage Against the Machine, Radiohead, and Kanye West at the peak of his career.
He literally he had just put out Homecoming. He was coming back to Chicago for the first time.
Oh,
it was
man.
Like it. Lollapalooza was right in the middle of Chicago that year. It was insane.
Yeah. And Rage playing on stage at a show they weren't protesting. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah, I know, right?
that's amazing in itself. Wow, holy shit!
Yeah, I mean they were so great about crowd control. Just like, we know you are angry, but you are not angry at your brothers and sisters.
Save the money pit for the revolution, brothers, says Zach. And I was like, you're my favorite, man. Like, I love that Zach De La Rocca had to like be like, don't rock so hard.
Yeah. You're rocking too hard. Save it for the band.
Yeah, you know? For real.
Yeah.
And on the drive out, what else are you supposed to do driving through the boonies of the country? Love the boonies of the country, but it's not like there's a lot of, I don't know, podcasts at the time.
There weren't. There were no podcasts.
No podcasts.
So we started breaking stories and we started to think about, what would be really cool is if they did a Wolverine movie, but like in Japan. Man, right?
Yeah, really dates us.
Yeah. That'd be sick.
And we were damning on that idea. And then we're like, what if it's not a Wolverine movie? What if it's just kind of something we tell a story about? And that was kind of how we started cracking our very first script called Sundown. Effectively, it's about a group of samurai who are banding together to protect a small community against feral Japanese vampires.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, hell yeah, right? That's kind
Got
of
me.
Sold.
As did it, which was amazing. We came up with the idea on the way out. We wrote it on the way back, stopping outside of Yellowstone and just jamming out on, 80 pages in a day?
It was insane. Yeah.
And passed the computer back and forth. Awesome. And we realized that that was more productive and more fun than either of us had ever had working alone. And when you kind of have that kismet, you don't ignore it. So basically after that, our career in Hollywood started and we were off to the races and effectively have been creatively married ever since.
And then, comics, then comics came into our life through Rebecca Taylor at Arkea when we did Hacktivist and we got hooked on it. And as comics were a huge part of our childhoods, our teenage years, our young adulthood, our origin story as friends, leaning into it just made a lot of sense. And it's been like the best decision we ever made.
Yeah. Effectively. Yeah.
Yeah.
So as we talked to a lot of people, obviously most of our guests are like singular writers that do things alone. How is that back and forth? Like, are you guys just yelling ideas at each other? Are you like doing the old, like say one word and build a story, or like, how is that kind of work in the back and forth?
Sure. I mean, so we can start in a lot of different ways. The truth is a good portion of our process is exactly the same as the process that Colin just described about driving to Lala, which is, we put ourselves into a place like, like my house, his house, a balcony, a coffee shop, an office. We close the door and we talk. We just hang out like friends. Like, that's literally our process. We sit down and once we're done bullshitting about what we did that day or what video game we're super into or what book we read, eventually one of us will pull up. We have a spreadsheet that tracks all of our process we've had for a decade that just tracks everything we're doing because we do so much at a time in a bunch of different mediums. So we have to know what the next deadlines are. We pick that deadline. We know what it is. And we say, okay, great. Given that this is the next thing to do, or, you know, hey, maybe we're free to conceptualize on an idea. Hey, I've been thinking about X. And maybe that X is like a company has come to us and said, hey, we want you to come up with a pitch for Batman Beyond. Or maybe it's us sitting there and being like, hey, I thought maybe an interesting way in on a story I can't get it out of my head would be like a person who's going through this who runs up against this. And we just kind of put that on the table and see if it sparks for the other guy. And generally, because we've been working together for so long, something about it will spark. And we'll kind of start.
If Jack thinks there's something interesting in it, then probably I will also think there's something interesting.
And vice versa.
Might not be a story.
Right. And then we'll just talk about it. So it's sort of like the internal process for any writer. I tend to think, like, because we are all, you know, we are also individuals who have individual brains as much as we present like a hive mind, that individual brain still exists. And like the individual creative pattern still exists. We still do our own individual creative work, just not really in writing. So when we work together, it's a lot like how the brain works, where the brain has a bunch of different opinions that argue amongst themselves. And most of it's happening in your subconscious until your opinion comes out the winner. And that's what gets verbalized out of your mouth or in your brain. Once you sort of set on an opinion, but that's after your brain has done a bunch of internal deliberation. I just think we've externalized that process. So we have that conversation out loud and then sort of arrive at a joint opinion after that deliberation, and we have to make sure that it is a joint opinion so that we don't get to a position and we don't really. I think it's one of the cool things about our partnership is this hasn't really happened in 10 years where we will sell a thing on a pitch or something like that, and then we'll get into the actual mix and realize we have completely different opinions on what it is. We don't really do that. We have a pretty good understanding of like tone and character and plot and what our objective is for a comic, often what the artist is going to be or who, what kind of artist we're looking at. We'll know all of that before we put an idea in front of someone, which often means that we're doing a lot more work on spec up front than other writers, because we don't, we can't just be like, nah, I don't know, it's this and hope that they like it enough that we can develop it out. We actually do have to know internally enough of it to live. So that I guess is a little bit of a complication on the process, but otherwise I think it's just like any other writer. It just happens external rather than internal.
But it's also, you're correct. There's a lot of yelling. You're not going to get everything, you know, it's not like you're not going to immediately gel on everything. And sometimes you got to scream and holler at the other guy eventually, because they just don't fucking get it. How can they possibly be ignorant? And then you're like, what is this? And they're like, oh shit, that's what you meant?
Yeah.
That is
so. What I just heard was you cracked the code on life and found a way to make a living hanging out with your best friend, making pretend all day.
This is exactly it, and when people wonder why do we do it together, right? Why not just be individual writers? Because we could go be individual writers. Like, Colin is an excellent writer. He could do this without me. I am an excellent writer. Mm-hmm. I can do this without Colin, technically. The process is just not nearly as fun. It's not nearly, mm-hmm. and I don't think it results in as good work. I think both of us have done individual work, and we've had fun with that. But I think we both know that the other guy fills in a part of us that would otherwise be blind. And that might be an idiosyncrasy as a writer, right? That might be a thing that when people see it, they're like, oh, cool, that's how you know a Colin story, how you know a Jackson story. But when the two of us synergize, it just creates a different thing entirely. So it is simultaneously fun, and I think who knows what story is objectively better. But from our perspective, I think we end up with stories that feel more thought through, and even if they aren't like objectively, between the two of us, we can really know that we like thought it through and justified it and feel good. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like it helps us to never feel like we're like just winging it, because mm-hmm. which is an easy thing to do, I think, especially in comics when you're moving very fast and you're doing a lot at once.
Right.
It helps us stay focused, helps us make sure that there's like a quality control in every book, which doesn't mean that every book turns out great, but it does mean that we have, maybe a higher batting average than we would as individuals. And then otherwise, yeah, man, it's just a chance to like hang out with my best friend and tell stories, which we would do anyway. Awesome. You know, it's just this way we get to do it as a business, which is awesome. Really fun.
Yeah.
getting paid for it is, not going to lie, pretty good.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Pretty good. Pretty cool. Not a bad gig. Not a bad gig.
Pretty good.
Well, it also really helps. This is the other reason that we did it, is because we started in Hollywood. And in Hollywood, when you're like 23 and you're coming into these rooms with like big directors who are just throwing their dick around and trying to like do what they want at the cost of you, it is really, really valuable to have an ally in that room. And as an individual writer, you rarely do. So having a partner really means that we were always walking in with an ally. With somebody who we knew had our back. And so when we had huge heartbreaks in the early part of our career, and we had huge heartbreaks, we had dream jobs we lost, we had projects that we thought were going to go that never did. Like, our 20s are a graveyard of hopes and dreams. But because there were two of us and we're able to hold that together, like, drink to that. We were able to make it to our 30s where we were able to actually fulfill some of those hopes and dreams. You know what I mean? And I'm not sure that would have happened. I think as an individual writer, I might have crumbled. But when you're together with another guy, it's a different scenario. It's a band of brothers thing.
It's that kind of funny thing, because it's like sometimes you're like, man, I can see really Jack's hurting. He needs me to be strong right now.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can pick each other, you can protect each other and pick each other up. But it's like, look, we're both fucking hurting, but like, I gotta be strong for my brother. Very rarely do both of us collapse.
Yeah. It's like a support system. Really quick, because you mentioned like sometimes you don't gel. We'll talk about the project soon, because you got fucking deadlines. But you said something I was gonna ask about, like, you don't gel sometimes, and I would assume that, I mean, you're very similar, but you definitely feel more passionate about like maybe one person to be more into Batman Beyond or Aquaman or something like that. So is there times where you come to like an impasse, or like you can't sort something out? How does that work for you guys? Or
I can only think of one time really where we could not gel and we had to bail on a concept. Ironically, then it turned into something else that just fucking rips. But I'm big into like Beefcake and pinup and like general wild horniness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to me, that is just like, you could have an entire story and it is just about being horny. And I think that's delightful.
My writing is like extremely asexual. It takes a lot to get a sex scene into my work. I don't know why this is, but it is genuinely, it's probably the biggest difference between us, is that I don't really write sex into my stuff. Like, romance, sure. Mm-hmm. I just don't tend to get there with my stuff. I it's not really where my brain goes. And Colin, it's like a priority in his work. So we do actually hit an impasse on that sometimes. Yeah.
So Colin, you read a lot of manga then?
For me, my man, it's all dragon riders of Pern.
Oh, hell yeah.
I mean, that's the interesting thing, right? Like, that's one of the right. only times that we both come at each other and it's like, look, there's no bridging this gap. Right. And this was specifically just on my mind. We did a short story for the most recent DC anthology series that was like a Valentine's Day issue. Hence why I was like, it's making horny. And they pitched us Sergeant Rock and, you know, Dinosaur Island. Love on Dinosaur Island.
That was all they had. They came at us. They were like, romance on Dinosaur Island with Sergeant Rock. We don't know what that means. We don't know what it is.
Good luck.
Romance on Dinosaur Island. Do you have a pitch?
Yeah.
And, you know, we kind of were both playing with these ideas, and I was definitely pushing for like kind of a Shauna the She-Devil. Like, he finds a sexy cave woman and they...
Yeah, like a Red Sonja kind of thing.
Or, exactly. And we go back and forth, and eventually Jack is just like, nope, I don't want to like this. This isn't good. There's no sport here. You just want tits? And I'm like, I know, it's tits. And we went back to the drawing board and had to look like, okay, well, where's the character? Like, what are we going to settle on? And as always, what we settle on is character.
Right.
We dove into the idea of what would it really matter? It's like, if you were Sergeant Rock, trapped on a dinosaur island, what would it mean? And we cracked onto this idea that it's not really about him. It's about the dinosaurs that are in love. And like showing this kind of romance between two velociraptors. And through their affection for each other, these two monsters, these two killers finding the humanity in each other, Sergeant Rock's heart cracks open because he's been so long without any kind of companionship, without someone he actually cares about. He sees this humanity in these dinosaurs and it rekindles something in him. Wow. So he gets to feel like maybe there will be something for him after the war. Maybe he doesn't just need to be Sergeant Rock. Maybe he can just be Rock.
Wow.
Right.
Salt. Ooh, you know, yeah.
But that,
and then you're like, but dinosaur tits.
Right. But that is, I think, a really good example of the process working, right? That's actually not the process not working. That's just the process taking a little bit longer. Like, I have a story. I'm sure I told this story on the last podcast or the last show. So I'll make this really short. But like the story I always tell about us not agreeing, I don't even remember what it was about. I genuinely don't. Mm-hmm. It was like we hit a thing where Colin had an opinion on a scene and I had an opinion on a scene. I think it was in Star Trek Year 5, but I genuinely can't recall. And we could not for the life of us square it out. Like, I just had a difference of opinion in terms of what this was about, and call it a difference of opinion about what this was about. And we had to get so deep into where our opinions were coming from and like why we had these opinions and what the objective we were trying to get to the audience was. And like, we had to get, and this is, again, I think the bug and the feature of the process is we have to become subconscious, like aware of our subconscious in a way that most writers don't, just because we have to communicate it to the other guy. And
deep into trauma.
Yeah, right? We have to like talk about our shit. It's like therapy.
Yeah, like where's it coming from?
Yeah,
yeah.
And we got into it, and like, and that involved like talking. You know, this is, I'm getting animated about it. We got 10 times as animated as I am right now, sitting on at this table, just going at each other about this. And we finally hit a thing where it's like, oh, that's what you mean? It was like, yeah, man, that's what I mean. And we were like, cool. And we started writing.
Okay.
And then it got done, and Colin was like, cool. And by the time we're done writing normally, like in person together, because we write separately most weeks and then we get together on Thursdays and Sundays, we have for a decade. And by the time we were done with that Sunday writing session, we tend to be pretty exhausted. And so Colin was like, you know, it was like 6, and he was like, all right, I'm going home. I was like, all right, later, dude. He's like, all right, later. And he leaves. And the door closes, and my wife, who's been on the couch this whole time doing her own shit, turns around and goes, what the fuck was that? And I was like, well, she was like, I thought you guys were going to kill each other. Like, I thought that's like the worst fight you guys have ever had. And then you just stopped. And we were like, yeah, because we solved the issue. And then we wrote. And she was like, wild. And I was like, yeah, I know. I don't know. Like,
it just works.
Like, I don't know why it works either. It just does. Like,
that's amazing.
Yeah, a lot of trust.
That is.
So,
that is. Yeah.
So yeah, we should talk about some of the comics you have coming out. Let's start with the one that's ending. Let's start with Harbinger.
Great.
Yep.
What's going on with Harbinger since we last talked?
We are into the second run. The Harbinger is in its, I think the last time we spoke, it was on the upswing heading from 1 to 4, which was kind of, the Harbinger is kind of a V. It goes up to 4 and then down to 8. And that's the whole run. So we were getting to that midpoint last time. And that was all about getting Peter Stanchik, the lead of the Harbinger franchise, really getting his mind right. He's a character who's had a lot of trauma and had a lot of made a lot of really bad decisions, and that's been a big part of his character. And he's left a lot of hurt people in his wake, including himself. And we thought it was time, and really the whole mandate of the book from the very beginning was to find a way to bring Peter some peace, to quote, I mean, for lack of a better term, to fix Peter Stanchik. But I don't think he was broken. I think he was just, I think he, you told about all the stories you could tell with that guy before he needed to look himself in the eye and start to improve. And the character had been promised for years to become this better man, to become a leader of men. We knew he was supposed to become in a lot of ways like a Superman figure for the Valiant universe, but getting him there wasn't as easy as like flipping a switch. You had to do the work, right. Just like any self-improvement. Right. So issues 1 through 4 is all about doing that. And then issues 5 through 8 is all about the fallout from that, about what happens when the whole world, now that you've held yourself accountable, the entire world decides to hold you accountable as well. How you live in spite of that.
And, you know, one of the things that we did here is, you know, like, let's see, which issue just dropped?
6. Just dropped. Mm-hmm. Or 2 more issues.
4. Well, you know, the big revelation in issue 4 is that Peter's psyche has effectively been broken off. And the Peter we've been following is really only half of who he used to be. Mm-hmm. His negativity, all the things that he views as the toxicity that is himself, he schismed off into a separate person, a character we call the Renegade. And the Renegade is this very real embodiment of all that kind of toxic masculinity, but also just toxic personal choice that he has become. And these last 4 issues are really about approaching that and looking at it and not just saying like, oh, you're a bad guy, right? Because it's not a bad guy. It's still right. Peter Stanchik, right? It's part of him. You can't ignore who you are, even if, God, you would love to pretend that wasn't yourself. You can't do it. So what we really wanted to do with these last 4 issues is look that in the face and have Peter face the idea that he can't cut this part away from him. He needs to face it. And obviously it's a fucking superhero book with Robbie Rodriguez pumping out amazing goddamn art. He's going to face it in the most high octane, awesome way possible. Like obviously, you know, what we wanted to do here is turn up the entire stakes, create out of our little Psyop community, this town, this part of Chicago called Psyop City, and then put it under threat. So with the Renegade's rise to power, he is activating Psyops. He is taking control of their powers. He is twisting them into the same kind of negative influences that he himself embodies, and then bringing that thunder and that pain and that trauma back to the citizens of New York. And very much so with that perspective of, look, if you can't love me for who I am, then fuck you. Your house gets to burn.
It was a really therapeutic book to work on in 2020 and 2021 when I think we were all going through a lot of reckoning in terms of how we live within our society, but also how we live within our families, within our social groups. And both of us as white men dealing with our internal responsibilities and what we have within culture, from like a privilege perspective, a lot of that got to be conversations that we didn't just get to have between each other, but conversations that got to spill onto the page and really get spoken about and interrogated within the fiction of Harbinger. So I'm super proud of that book because it is not just an exploration of this one character or a very like targeted look at this one psyche. I think it gets to be a larger artifact from a cultural conversation that kicked off while we were working on it. So I think I hope people can look back at this book several years from now and see, like, it's one of those places where I think I'm glad it feels dated. Like, I hope people look back at it and go, wow, that's really definitely a book that came out in 2022, because like it feels like a book that came out in 2021 and 2022. It feels like it hums with the the exact like conversation we were having at that time, but then really made some adjustments and changes in the Valiant universe moving forward. It is a pivot.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things where it's like the book's not going to go back to being what it was. Harbinger is sort of fundamentally adjusted as a result, which has been has been a blast and a real responsibility to take.
It was almost necessary for the character too, I think.
I think so.
When you talked about
it. I think so. But, we also got to bring in Faith. For those of you who are wondering, like, should I read this? I don't know if I've ever really been a Harbinger fan. We got to bring in Faith, who, if you got onto the Valiant Universe in Faith, which I know a lot of people did, this is the follow-up to that. We're coming right off of Jody Hauser's arc. Jody's a close friend of ours, so we, like, consulted with her. She has been helped, you know, get behind what we're doing. You'll see some specific references in issue 6 to her run. That's just been a real joy to get to do as well, because what a character. And certainly one who has a lot to say about heroism and privilege. So that was really fun.
Right.
Yeah. Faith is such a fun character.
Oh, she's great, man. She's great.
So let's move over to DC then. And let's start with arguably one of, so to put this to both of you, you're currently touching three of my favorite characters of all time.
Hell
with
yeah.
The next two we're going to talk about. So let's start with Batman Beyond. You got to do the Batman Urban Legends, and
you got to kill Bruce Wayne.
You got to Bruce Wayne, and yes, now we're going into the main series, which everybody listening, that book is on shelves right now as you're listening to it, so go buy it.
Came out today.
Yes, came out today. Yeah. So what's up with Batman Beyond, besides killing Bruce?
What is? Yeah. So, as you said, Urban Legends, number 7, we got to kick off this story. They asked us to come in with 30 pages. We did, but we also came in with where those 30 pages took us, because those 30 pages were a kickoff. They were an investigation of what happens the night of Bruce Wayne's murder, who did it, how it was done, and why. I'm going to spoil that story. So if you haven't read Urban Legend 7 and you just want to hit this all, like, you're like, oh, there's new Batman Beyond, just go read it now. Or, you know, whatever. You're about to get spoiled.
Is that story in Neo Year number 1?
No.
Or do you have to get Urban Legends?
No, you have to go back and get Urban Legends number 7 if you want that story. We are going to recap that story in issue 1. Like, page 1 of issue 1 of Neo Year is going to tell you the plot of Urban Legends number 7. So if you didn't read it, don't worry about it. We're going to get you up to speed. But I really do think of it as the zero issue for this run. And when the trade's collected, it'll certainly be in the trade. So I would recommend that people go back, grab it on Comixology, grab a physical copy if you can find it, and read it as soon as you can. Or I guess Kindle, because Comixology doesn't exist anymore. Thanks, Amazon.
Yeah, don't even get me started.
Oh, man, don't. I'm so mad.
I got my pitchfork. Hold on.
But so, suffice to say, spoiler alert, in issue 7 of Urban Legends, we have this 30-page story. It is about Terry McGinnis on the night of Bruce Wayne's murder. Bruce's pacemaker explodes. Someone has hacked into his pacemaker and blown up Bruce Wayne's heart. And Bruce tasks Terry with keeping on the Batman legend, but having to go beyond what being Batman means. And Terry doesn't entirely understand what that means. The night of Bruce is dying, he's kind of losing consciousness. He's not making a lot of sense. But Terry resolves that he's going to do this. And what Terry learns over the course of the night, that night investigating Bruce's murder, is that the thing that did it, the person who killed Bruce Wayne, is the gestalt consciousness of all of Gotham City. That Gotham City's all of its various AI constructs, because it's, you know, it's Neo Gotham, it's the future, everything's automated, have all networked together through the Bat Computer, which tracks everything in Neo Gotham, and has
been tracking it for years,
and has become alive. And once it became alive, it was able to look at Gotham City and said, "Well, Batman hasn't really actually stopped crime in Gotham City. I can stop crime in Gotham City, but I can't have Batman running around doing it while I do it. So the first thing I'm going to do is kill Bruce Wayne, because I know Bruce Wayne is Batman." Wow. So done. And Gotham gets, like, effectively the thing that Bruce has spent his whole life protecting betrays him at his last moment. And then turns its eyes on Terry and turns its eyes on the legacy of Batman. Terry blows up the Batcave at the end of that issue, leaving the Batcomputer, you know, completely destroyed, but effectively making the living Gotham take over the rest of Gotham City. And now Terry is out there alone with no Bruce, with no Ace, with no Batcave, with no gadgets, with limited supplies on the Batsuit, and a city that knows who he is and wants to kill him. He is out there having to follow up that promise to Batman, that promise to Bruce, to keep Batman alive. And that's where Neo Year number one kicks off. The idea behind Neo Year, which is a six-issue, Batman Beyond Neo Year, which is a six-issue run, is to give Terry McGinnis his own year one, to give him his own time to become Batman under his own power, under his own duress, without Bruce in his ear. Terry has been a Batman apprentice for the entire existence of Batman Beyond. We want him to become Batman in his own right and understand what that means for him. And that's going to involve a lot of pain and a lot of hurt and a lot of darkness and a lot of survival and a lot of resilience. We liken it a lot to Frank Miller's Year One. I liken it a lot now that I've seen the Batman to the Batman. I don't know how we ended up on such similar wavelengths, but like, we are very much talking about the same stuff as Matt Reeves and his team in our own way, obviously. But I loved that movie, and I was really surprised how much it was resonating with what we were trying to do with Neo Year. So that is our. That's my hard sell on Neo Year. Like, it's a whole new Terry McGinnis story. It is a whole new Neo Gotham. We're bringing in new villains. We're bringing in new heroes. We're bringing in new allies. It is a brand new day for Terry, and it's going to be a hard one for him to get through.
Brand new day and an even darker night.
Nice. There you go. Chapter two.
Yeah, that's the process. Jack says all the awesome things that I'm like. Catchphrase.
But I have a question. Yeah, and it's funny because when you were talking about like Gotham being alive, the one thing I thought about the Batman the movie was the best representation of Gotham in a movie, and it almost is a character in itself. So you effectively have taken Gotham and said, okay, well, how would it feel about Batman trying to help and failing? You know, failing consistently. But so how do you write the city as a character, essentially?
Yeah, well, so Jack and I actually have a long history of let's say, call it cyber fiction from our time with Hacktivist, which was our very first book. We, to make sure that that book was as authentic and true as possible, we went down a deep research rabbit hole, not only down into computer theory and AI theory, but also working with members of Anonymous, really kind of finding out how this kind of counterculture works. And that's what we really wanted to inject into the story. The thing that we quickly hit on with the Living Gotham is that it could not be just a monotone kind of Hal, right? Yeah. This needs to be a character. And so we really develop the voice of the Living Gotham in order to kind of create this living person who could clash against Terry. One of the things we realized when we first started working on Batman Beyond was, you know, what's the heart of his villain's rogue gallery, right? Batman's rogue gallery, right. Bruce's rogue gallery is different variations of his own psychosis. For Terry, his rogues gallery is really built around the abuse and manipulation of technology of the future, right? Almost every one of them is how can we corrupt and break down these fundamentally maybe decent ideas? And that's what we wanted to look at with Living Gotham, the idea that from a galaxy brain standpoint, what Batman's doing is not important, right? To the Living Gotham, the point isn't to stop crime. Stopping crime is impossible. What you can do is even it out. What you can do is make the line flat.
Keep the line flat. Keep the line flat became the Living Gotham's entire framework. It became a phrase that we used a lot over the course of the book, because the idea is not to save everyone. The idea is to save the effective amount of people. If everyone, it's sort of like unemployment, right? People are always like, well, if you get to zero unemployment, what happens? It's like the system doesn't work anymore. It's like, well, I mean, that's true. And that should probably tell us something about employment. Right. But it doesn't. It just tells us, oh, well, we should never get to zero unemployment. We maybe take the wrong lesson. Gotham looks at crime and goes, well, I can't get to zero crime. What I can do is get to a manageable amount of crime where, say, three people die in muggings every night, but all the other muggings are stopped. Well, cool. I get three sacrifices right. a night. That's what I need to keep the line flat. That's good. And that's where Batman needs to be, right? Batman needs to be the gum in that works, looking after the people that the society, that the city decides are not worth its time. Decides are worthwhile sacrifices or negligible sacrifices.
And that's the human part of Batman, right? Is the hope. Right. Once again, that's why fucking Matt Reeves got it, man. Batman is not about punching and kicking. Batman is about inspiration and hope, because Batman will always, always fight, always push to save everyone. Even if he knows he can't, he will never stop. And that's the real difference. Living Gotham is happy to accept that this is as good as it gets. Mm. Bruce Wayne, Terry McGinnis, never will.
Awesome. So you could almost say he's like an urban legend.
It's almost full circle.
It's almost like you could.
Wow.
We also gave ourselves a little bit of a fun twist on it, which people will see when they pick up issue one. So I'm not going to spoil it here. But finding a way to externalize the Living Gotham so it's not just a voice in Terry's ear, because as we establish in Urban Legends, it has access to the Bat Cowl. So the idea is like it can just whisper in his ear the way that Batman used to, which I just love as a general storytelling move, because it takes the Batman Beyond framework and flips it on its head. Suddenly, you don't have a comforting voice in your ear. You have your Joker effectively in your ear, which is just a very different thing for Batman to have to solve. But we also needed a way to externalize that. So looking at the kinds of villains that the Living Gotham can manufacture for Batman to run up against in a physical meat space kind of way, that felt very important. So you're going to meet one of them in issue one. You're going to meet one of them in issue, or you're going to meet a couple of them in issue one. You're going to meet another one in issue two. Like, we're introducing a whole new rogues gallery for Terry. Awesome. And that led us to, just to galaxy burn out for a hot second, that led us to, I think, the biggest adjustment that we're making to Terry, and why I think this, I sort of call Neo Year a brand new day. It's not just like marketing language. We're trying a different thing, right? We're blowing up a lot of the Batman Beyond framework, which I understand, like, some fans will be like, where's my classic Batman Beyond? It's like, I understand we're doing something different. Part of what part of what attracted us to this as Batman Beyond fans is that I don't know where else to go with the old framework. I think the old framework was great, but I think they kind of ran it through. I think that was all you could
do. The show's fucking perfect.
The show's great.
The show's fucking perfect.
The show's
perfect.
And then
you hit Return of the Joker, and it's like, this is...
Yeah. Brilliant.
A perfect collection.
There's no real reason for us to try to like continue a cover version of that. The important thing for us is like, if we're going to do this, we need to play a new song. So the biggest, and this was a conversation, you want to talk about our process, like this was a big conversation between Colin and I, which was, what does a new framework for Terry's villains look like? Because to be totally honest, Terry's framework of villains is Spider-Man's framework of villains. It's people who have technological responsibility who then go crazy over that technology. It's the same, like the framework for Green Goblin is the same framework as Blight. The framework for Ink is very similar to the framework for Black Cat or Dr. Octopus. You end up with very similar frameworks between Spider-Man and Batman Beyond. And so we thought, all right, if we're going to create a new ascension of him into a new level of Batman, then we need to really look at like what Terry's psychology is dealing with and put him up against villains who challenge that. So I think you're going to see villains whose entire framework is designed less around the perversion of technology and more around the acceptance or lack of acceptance of responsibility and legacy, because that's what Terry's going through. Terry is going through a story about how we use the legacies that have been left for us by the past and how we carry them into the future. And his villains and his allies are all going to be living with their own legacies or building their own legacies and trying to understand how to inherit those or push them forward or how to destroy them. We're going to try to redirect the sort of theme conversation of Batman Beyond around what Terry's going through now in this year. And see how that goes. So that's maybe our biggest swing that we're taking, but I think it's going to be a really fun one.
Okay.
And you'd be really remiss if we didn't at this point hype up Max Dunbar's amazing fucking art.
Yes.
We had no idea what this book was going to be until his art started rolling in. And I mean, I think anyone who takes a look at those pages just gets their mind pretty blown. Max is doing the work of his career. We are so fucking happy to have him on this team. He is this team.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely blowing it away with every single issue. Like getting Batman, obviously being a comics writer, getting your art in is always one of the best things, but I mean, it's fucking Batman, baby.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And Max is just absolutely bringing the thunder. It's so fucking cool.
Yeah. I love his stuff with like Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, that's the thing. He's like a fantasy. Yeah. He's such a sort of famous fantasy artist. So when we started talking about him for the book, we were like, well, yeah, but like, how is it going to be when we like apply that to a cyberpunk aesthetic? And it turns out really good. Really, really fucking seamless. Yeah. Turns out he knew exactly what to do.
Awesome. Well, we had one note from him early. It was like, well, Gotham, think about Neo Gotham from the show. And it's sky like a bruise. Buildings that are just fucking monoliths. Mm-hmm. No windows, just giant stone fucking slabs, canyons, and mountains.
Yep.
And I think for the first time he's created a Neo Gotham that feels, I mean, it feels epic. It feels huge. It feels bigger than Batman can possibly protect.
Okay.
Which is awesome because Jerry McGinnis has no options. And he has to protect all of them.
And it's his villain.
That's awesome.
Wow. So let's go real quick on the next one because I really want to get into Captain America. Totally. But let's talk about Aquaman, Flash, Void Song. That's the 3-issue series you got coming up in a few months. What can we expect from that real quick?
Aquaman, Flash, Void Song is in a lot of ways the opposite. What we wanted to do with it is effectively tell a Silver Age pulp guitar riff of a book. It is fast. It is fun. It has a lot of heart. But we didn't really want to dive into, you know, we're not exploring the trauma of Barry Allen. We're not really, you know, there's not a lot of brooding going on. There is brooding. Good. There is trauma, 100%.
Right.
But the point is, you want to see these two guys kicking ass. Never really seen this particular team up before. And that was the big question. You know, obviously, you got two movies coming out. They were like, we would really love a story that features these two guys.
Yeah, let's not try to hide the origin, right? Yeah, like DC has two movies. They're like, hey, these two guys should star in a comic. That would be great. Is there a way for the two of them? And that was the challenge that was brought to us.
Okay. Almost like it's a business.
Almost
like it's a business.
Yeah.
You know, we don't take jobs unless we can tell a story that absolutely rips. So after a bit of bashing our heads against the wall, because honestly, why do Flash and Aquaman team up?
How does it happen?
Make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
We landed on the Void Song as a villain and their very unique kind of turn and what they actually want to do here on Earth. And once we landed on that kind of combination that unites these two men, we really realized we had a story cooking because they are very different. Obviously, they come at the superheroing perspective from very different angles. But the thing that does unite them, oddly enough, is their wives. They both love their wives so much. They're wife guys.
Yep. They are two big time wife guys.
Yep. Yeah.
And once you put them in danger, more than anything else, that can unite them. So we really want to do, you know, yes, the entire planet is in danger. Yes, this is a giant Independence Day. I'm not going to say it's a crisis, but I mean, like, it's kind of along those lines.
Yep.
But the thing that really matters is Iris and Mira. And once you put their lives on the line, these guys have no choice but to unite. But once again, they have very different operating MOs. They have very different perspectives. So much like Jack and I, like, you can kind of get along. But then when you get deeper, you're like, what the fuck is this guy's deal?
Right.
But it is only through that clash, that yelling at each other over the table, that you can find the united goal. Realize that you both want to get to the same place and then unite and go kick the ass of aliens, as Jack and I often do.
One of the fun things about working in a partnership is that I think we have a little bit more, and I think it's also probably a downside in terms of like getting an audience initially, is that we are very flexible in terms of tone. You're not just going to find a story that's like, you know, like, I know writers who, when you read them, like, I think a really good example of this is like Ram V, right? Ram's a friend of ours. When you read a Ram book, you know a Ram book. Ram writes like Ram all the time, and he sort of has one mode, and that mode is Ram. It's great. It's awesome. And you go to it for exactly that. We don't have that. We have several versions of us that you can find. You'll find, and we sort of talk about them internally. You sort of have the hacktivist version of us. You have the Zojicon version of us. You have the Joyride version of us. And those present really differently. And they pop in at different places. Like the Batman Beyond version of us, that's sort of the hacktivist version that's playing over there. Like on Aquaman Void Song, you're really getting, or Aquaman Flash Void Song, you're really getting the like Joyride version of us mixed in with all we've learned about writing superheroes and epics since we did that book way back. Like, it is fun, it's poppy, it's four color. The art is by Vasco Georgiev, who, if you have not seen his work yet, is a just, like, his stuff couldn't be more inviting and optimistic and exciting and glossy.
A lot of heart.
There's so much heart in it, but there's also just so much adventure and pulp. We brought him onto it. Like, once we figured this out, we were like, there's two ways we can go with this. There's the version where you bring in like a Brian Hitch, where the whole thing feels very like authority and feels like very, you know, it's an alien invasion story. So it can get very like dark and intense, like very early. Or there's the version where you're really playing this fun and not like necessarily light, but fun and big and adventurous. And that felt more exciting to us right now. We were really playing very dark in Batman Beyond, and we're playing pretty dark in Captain America. And so this was really a chance for us to play a little lighter and to play a lot more fun and just really exercise a different muscle of what we do. So that's sort of how Void Song came about. And then, as Colin points out, it's really deeply personal because it is at its heart about two guys who don't really get along, who do the same thing and do it very well, learning to get along and become a team. It's a story about how these two men become or don't become friends in the midst of a giant crisis that can only rely on the two of them, where every other toy in the DC universe is off the board. It's just these two guys and a fleet of aliens. How do they manage it? What does that look like? The mandate was not let's make the audience, you know, soul search themselves super hard. The mandate here was let's bring the audience on an incredibly fun ride that if they've never read a comic before, if they've just seen The Flash or just read Aquaman or just seen Aquaman, that they can walk into this, they can walk to the comic store for the very first time, get a graphic novel, because it's presenting as three issues, but ultimately it is a graphic novel. Like, these are 48 page issues that are each a chapter of one big book. They can walk in, they can get this big book, and they can get their first big comic book adventure. It doesn't take place in the movie universe. It takes place in the DC universe, but not in any kind of continuity where we're like worried about interconnectivity. It is a standalone adventure story with these two men. It is weirdly personal for us because of who we are and how our friendship operates.
Amazing.
So we hit Batman Beyond. We hit Aquaman.
Yum, yum.
Let's talk about the big one. So you guys are a part of the team that's relaunching Captain America in two different books. You're taking over Steve Rogers.
Yep.
And you're gonna be
Oh my God. Yeah.
That's the one we
and,
got?
Yeah. And you're doing this issue zero, and then it's leading into the two different books where Steve and Sam both have their own mantle and everything. So as a huge Captain America fan and someone who's been somewhat disappointed with the recent launches, why should I be excited about Captain America Sentinel of Liberty?
All right. All right. So where to even start? I'm going to start at the easiest place, I think, which is Carmen Carnero is fucking killing it. I don't even care if you like our story. Mm-hmm. Carmen's art is so good that you could read it with no context and just be like, this is some of the best Captain America art ever produced. It is truly spectacular work. She understands Steve Rogers as a character better than any artist I have ever seen. I think she just nails the man behind the mask so well. You could just get it for the art, if for no other reason, that's how good the art is. Now,
and I think that's a little, there's a sub column there, which is, I guess that's one of the other elements here is before we even get to the big stuff, the key really is, I think you hit it on the head. There's a Sam book and there's a Steve book.
Yeah,
they are both Captain America, but it was incredibly important to us, to Alana, to Tom, to Carmen, to tell a story that wasn't just about the suit, but was about Steve. Every one of our issues, we try and have it, you know, we try for at least 50% to be about Steve himself. We want to see the man. We want to know, we want to meet his new friends. We want to see the human being who carries this shield, and the quiet moments. We, as you'll pick up in issue one, what we have almost immediately is he's moving home, right? We want to take him back to the streets, to Manhattan, to where he grew up, to try and reconnect to the man that he used to be. He is an artist. He's a tender soul, right? He just has to step up to protect not only America, but in a lot of cases, the world. But we did not want to lose that fundamental humanity that is behind the man. And that was that was one of the most important things to us and to Carmen, was making sure that we do not forget that Steve Rogers is one of the best men who's ever lived.
It does not matter if he's in the suit or if he's holding the shield. That this is a Steve Rogers book. Now, that said, why get excited about a new Captain America launch after, you know, years of great Captain America, but a lot of, frankly, playing the same song? Playing Red Skull, playing Crossbones, playing the road trip across America as we learn the devastating realities of American injustice. These are all good stories and stories that need to be told and stories that have now been told with Steve several times over. When we were asked to come onto this, and we were asked to come onto this, I've been very straightforward about this, like on the longest of shots, right? We had done Kang the Conqueror, and we'd surprised the people at Marvel with, I think, how we had done that how we could get audiences in on it. And so they brought us in to say, hey, do you want to take a shot at Cap? You won't get it, but at least we can see what you will bring to the table, right? And we came in with an idea that we have had for years, which effectively boils down to, and they've said this enough in the marketing materials that I feel like I'm comfortable saying this, which effectively boils down to the shield. The symbol on that shield, those three rings and that star in the center, are not what you think. They mean something else. They are a map. They are a code. They are a symbol. And they are the tip of a story iceberg that if Steve discovers it, that when Steve discovers it, is going to not just change his understanding of the Captain America mantle, but is going to open up an entire new universe of villains, of heroes, of allies. You're going to hear a lot of the same framework that we talk about when we talk about Batman Beyond, because for us, it's not worthwhile unless we're playing a new tune. So we're coming into Captain America hoping to carve out an entire new story area for him. I promise you, we are not playing the hits here. We are coming in and we are doing a new thing with this character that's going to take some real risks, that's going to push him into some places that are going to be uncomfortable, that are going to push him into some places that are going to open up some big secrets in terms of the Marvel Universe. And the story is going to be one that looks up and one that looks big, not one that looks down and gets small. So rather than doing a story about getting Steve on a motorcycle, going and solving like small town America problems, which is, I think, what his mode has been for a very long time now, we are going to have Steve looking up into the larger systems that run our world and realizing the deep injustice that is ingrained there. And not the injustice of like some baddie at the UN doing something mean to someone. I'm talking about worldwide global supervillain conspiracy stuff. We're taking Cap back into the mad science world. We're taking Cap back into a world of not just the injustice that we see every day, but the larger scale systemic injustice that keeps us all in boxes. We want Steve Rogers to be looking at universal injustice and finding ways to fight it directly head on, but to do that, really reckoning with his own involvement in it and what that symbol on his shield means. So without spoiling anything, that's where it's getting started and that's where it's kicking off. And then my sort of like my little additional punch to like make sure you get into this is the book is like a lot of our stories about brotherhood. So this isn't just going to be about Steve Rogers. This book is very much a two-hander with Bucky Barnes. And we are taking the Winter Soldier, who I also think has effectively been stuck in one story almost since his creation, and we are moving him into his next story. And we are doing so unapologetically. We are going to be changing some stuff with Bucky and Steve. We are going to be making some real course adjustments on these characters and throwing some big new obstacles in their way that are going to change their relationship and change the way that they operate inside the Marvel Universe. So these are not like, it might sound like I'm overselling it, but truthfully, for these two characters, it's a pivotal book. It is a book that if, you know, unless somehow our entire run disappears tomorrow, is going to have some real ramifications on the Marvel Universe on a longer term perspective. We're not telling a minor story. We are coming in with a full bore reconstruction of Steve and Bucky's relationship, and also Steve's relationship with his own legacy and the mantle itself.
Awesome.
And, just like you know, obviously you mentioned the Zero issue, which is just we actually wrote as a almost like a jazz session with Toshi. You know, passing pages back and forth, making sure it's these two, you know, it's Sam and Cap coming at the same problem from literally two different angles.
Literally, Sam, all of Steve's stuff written by us, all of Sam's stuff written by Tochi, and sometimes sharing page space. So we were literally like working around
that's
each
cool.
other.
That's cool.
It was rad.
That's really cool.
Some classic Arnim Zola in there, just being the most Zola he can possibly Zola. And it's a beautiful, rad issue about these two men. But if you want the other prequel story, because why not? We have a single issue of Devil's Reign, of Chip's run of event Devil's Reign, Winter Soldier, where Bucky has found himself pushing into Fisk's mansion, looking for some of these documents, because he knows there are secrets in his own past that he still has not cracked. He hasn't slept in weeks. He is starting to become disassociative to reality itself because he doesn't know who he is truly, because he knows it goes deeper. And that is what he's digging on. And so if you're going to pick up that story and you see the kind of trauma that Bucky is dealing with, that is the guy we are going to meet in our Captain America run. And while he meets Steve and he seems like that good old Bucky, we all know that when he goes home,
he's going through something, some stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I can confirm to everybody out there, good issue. So I know we're close on time. I just got to get two quick questions about Captain America, and then we'll do our closing. One of the things that's been bugging me about Cap in recent Cap runs, are we past Secret Empire? Like, have we put that in the past? Okay. Yep.
I can tell you fundamentally, we never mention it.
Okay.
Like I genuinely do not think we have mentioned Secret Empire once. I think he is. In fact, that was a big part of our
once we mentioned it as like a hat tip because it happened. We know it happened, and we know that it was one of those fundamental things that like tarnished the Captain America legacy in a big way. Yes. Steve knows it too.
But I think a big part of what the last few books have been saddled with, frankly, like the entire Coates run and Cantwell's run as well, were designed very much around reinterrogating what Steve meant and getting him back to a place where he could reliably, comfortably, and confidently be Captain America. Mm-hmm. I can tell you fundamentally, Steve is not going to be like looking at himself in the mirror being like, do I deserve this? Am I really an evil Hydra agent? None of that is happening with us anymore. He is through that part of his process. Steve has gotten clear on Secret Empire.
I loved Secret Empire. I thought it was a great event, and I liked what Wade did afterwards. I felt like we kept going back to that well too much. But
yeah,
it's second question, the more important question for you.
Yeah.
Will I see MODOK in this book?
So let me tell you,
redacted.
Redacted. Can I tell you that I don't know yet, and we'll leave it at that?
Okay. Solid.
We think MODOK fucking rips.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Yeah. I'll tell you that MODOK is not out of the conversation, and is something we are very interested in because we have a take. But our focus early on with these characters is, just like with Beyond, is new shit. You're going to be seeing new villains. You're going to be seeing new stuff. So early on, not a lot of hits getting played. But looking at, like, Arnim Zola is the only guy we're bringing in early that's like, oh, that's like a Cap villain I recognize. Soon, though, I certainly
listen. You want to do Elvis MODOK too? I'm cool with that too. I love Elvis MODOK. I just love me some MODOK.
He'll take what he can get, honestly.
Yeah.
You know what? We'll send this to Tom.
So before we cut you off, Mike and I have to do our quick pitch because you're DC writers.
Yeah.
So we got to pitch to you the greatest DC villain of all time that's never used.
We've done it. Codpiece.
I think Jackson, we did this with you. Colin, are you aware of the character Codpiece?
Codpiece.
God, no. I don't think you did this
for me either. What is Codpiece?
It's the issue right after the Grant Morrison run of Doom Patrol.
Doom Patrol issue. Number 70. Greatest single issue of a comic ever written.
Yep, and Codpiece, I don't know if he's on the cover, but he shows up, and he is a villain with a mechanical codpiece that shoots various different gadgets out of it. Yeah,
Wait, it shoots gadgets out of his codpiece?
So, yeah, there's like very,
it can be,
yeah.
It can be used as a cannon. At one point, it uses a drill.
Yep.
It's very, you can like do whatever you want with it.
It's like Inspector Gadget, but the hat is on the crotch, you know what I mean? Like different things pop out, I guess, like almost like a utility.
And here I was hoping that it was going to be a man with a cod head.
Oh, no.
Like a gangster. He's like a character for like the street level villains. All right.
Yeah. I thought it was gonna be like a cod on his junk.
Listen, well, I know you guys are going to go into a writing session after this. I just wanted to inspire just a little bit.
All right, so now it's Aquaman, Flash, Codpiece. Sorry, Void Song, you're out.
We made Codpiece.
Son of Codpiece.
Oh yeah, there
son
we go.
Of Codpiece.
There we go.
Oh my god. Sold.
Oh no.
He finds the codpiece and he's like, fuck, I can't wear this thing, but maybe if I like turn it into a hat.
Look,
no one will know.
Doom Patrol continues to be the source of the greatest one panel gags in DC Comics history. It's just an excellent book. I think I stopped at the Morrison run, so I don't think I ever read this issue.
So people don't know,
right?
Because it's like immediate issue after.
Right.
Oh my god.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
It's written by
Rachel Pollack, who's an amazing writer on her own, too.
I've heard that Rachel Pollack's run is amazing. I haven't read it.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And she may or may not be on the show very soon.
Amazing. Yeah, they're collecting it, right? Yeah. I thought I saw they're like doing a collection of it.
Yeah. So.
I'm excited to read it.
Mm-hmm.
God, and maybe we'll get live action codpiece.
There you go.
These are the things I dream about.
Yeah. Well, my buddy Matt Zook plays Negative Man on the show, so I'll just text him and be like, "Hey, tell the writers about Codpiece." I'll do that for you.
Yes. Oh my god.
This is Jackson. Both of you, you're welcome back anytime.
Jackson, Colin.
This could be the Chris, Mike, out. Jackson, and Colin show now because
you guys don't have time for it.
You'll have to fight Dan over at Gatecrashers, who keeps being like, "You're technically just hosts now." It's like, no.
Yeah. No, we're not.
So, guys, thank you so much for being on. We've taken enough of your time, and we greatly appreciate it. We have to do this again in the future once your next slate of books are announced. So,
hell yeah, man. Let's do it. Let's do it in the fall or winter once you've read Captain America, and you can tell us how much you hate it. Be great.
Oh yeah. And he will too.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
You guys gotta protect us because we're gonna take some swings and that might piss some people off.
Yeah, Captain America Sentinel Liberty 5, I'm getting off the internet. I'm just gonna warn you now. I'm calling my shot now.
Yep.
That's okay. I got your direct email now, so don't worry, I can get to you. All right, guys. Thanks again. Everybody out there, make sure to check the show notes down below for these guys' social and everything. And actually, do you want to pimp all that out before we take off?
At Jackson Lansing on Twitter. Easy find.
Yep. At CP Kelly on Twitter. The P is a mystery.
Oh, wow.
There you go.
Find out next episode.
Next time.
But thank you so much. This was a total blast. We appreciate the timeline because, as we mentioned earlier, we got some fucking deadlines.
Fucking deadlines.
And we're back
on the other side. So yeah, they're doing a lot of cool stuff that you should probably know about if you don't know about it. And I can't wait for the Batman Beyond book. So,
which, if you're listening to this the day it releases, is in comic book stores right now.
Right now. It's out there. So, yeah, I'm going to be reading it.
Fun fact.
Let's go to comic news. Marvel has announced the next installment in Peach Momoko's Japanese folklore-inspired universe called Demon Wars, The Iron Samurai. Four-issue series said to be a reimagining of Civil War inside the Momoko verse. I've never read anything about Momoko's verse. This cover for Demon Wars looks pretty cool, and Iron Samurai sounds awesome, so I'll probably check it out.
I want to check out her stuff.
Yeah.
I want to, because I like the art. Like, she's got this like watercolor-y, anime-y kind of look, and it's really cool.
Really cool. Marvel has announced its ongoing series, Shang-Chi, is ending with issue 12. Well, kind of. Because the series being... I should have known. Why do I fall for these traps? It's getting a new number one, folks, in the place of number 13, which was previously solicited. We'll get Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings, number one, same creative team. We had heard about them rebooting with the rings or whatever, getting him the rings somehow. Oh, God, the new number one thing, man. I wish it wasn't as much of a meme as it is, but it's really hard not to pay attention to it when they do it like this all the time.
Somebody at Marvel is just like, well, we could rename it to Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings and get a new number one. And then it also synergizes because people think Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, the movie, was really popular. In that sense, I think it makes sense, to be honest. As much as I agree with you, like, the number one thing is a little ridiculous, but... I'm not shocked at all. If anything, I'm shocked that it wasn't like announced prior and that they kind of did this bait and switch.
Right.
That seems kind of out, but yeah. You're still going to read it, Mike.
I'm still going to read it is what I'm going to say. But like, why can't you just like call it Shang-Chi Master Kung Fu? Because that's way cooler than the Ten Rings.
Well, you got to wait till Shang-Chi 2 Master Kung Master Fu comes Kung out. Fu comes and then they'll do it.
I gotcha. I see what they're doing now. So very sad news. Legendary artist Gary Leach passed away at the young age of 67. He's best known for his Marvel series, Marvel Man series, written by Alan Moore. Amazing art in that series. Also well known for longtime 2000 AD artist. Marvel Man's art was really good.
Yeah, that's a good story, too.
Yeah, great story. Very young. 67's young. Very sad to hear that. So condolences to him or to his family, and hope they're, doing okay. But very sad to hear that.
I love that Marvel Man series. It's really good. Also, just on a personal note, when I was reading this, doing the notes earlier in the week, it hit me because like that's around the same age as my dad. And I was like, oh, God.
Yeah, 67 is very young in this day and age, for sure. So that's really sad.
But yeah, sucks.
Let's talk about what we read this week. So I got some books to skim through because I read so many. I just want to focus on I want to give a spotlight to an indie book that I picked up in Kickstarter because I do pick up issues, physical issues now through Kickstarter, not all the time. But this is a really cool cover. This is one of the variant covers I got for Postmasters. And you probably would have liked this series. I don't know if, did you back this on Kickstarter?
I never heard of it, actually.
Oh, okay. So it's like it's almost like magazine format. It's just like the Black Label style size.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting book. It's very on the nose about, so there's a pandemic. It's written by Garrett Gunn, Christina Blanche, art by Ruben Mocho, and it's it's Source Point Press put it out.
Okay.
So it's very on the nose. There's a pandemic. The postmasters the pandemic is a little more mutagenic than our pandemic. So like the people that some people took the vaccine and like mutated from it and stuff. So there's almost like these demon looking people, and the postmasters are still, these are people that deliver the mail, but they're almost like swordsmen that deliver the mail because to get the mail from one place to the next, there's all these mutants like in the cities and stuff like that. So it's almost like I Am Legend in that sense. The art's really good. It's like a manga style art, but there's, you know, there used to be like 100 postmasters. Now there's like a handful of them. And this is one of the main ones on the cover. But it's a story of like, and you could tell like it, almost like the Hunger Games, that the rich people are the ones still using the mail. So like they get this letter that's like handwritten and all like very fancy. And it says like priority mail. So the people that can't afford to use it. So he goes to take this letter and gets ambushed. Then we meet another postmaster character that's really good at sword fighting. It's a really cool story. I mean, there's the, you know, the whole relation to the pandemic stuff, but he talks about how like, you know, the U.S. pretty much became a war zone because some people had these like freedom sites, you know, where they made factions and stuff like that. I thought it was really good, though. Solid first issue. I know Garrett's got another Kickstarter out, something, a Bad Wolf or something like that. So yeah, I think he's got a really cool style, and Christina Blanche obviously helped out, so they both wrote it together. Great first issue. And I really like the cover because it's got like gold lettering, so really cool,
shiny.
Yeah, I like.
Can I ask a follow up? Because I don't know if you misspoke or not. Because if you didn't misspoke, then I have questions. Did you say that the vaccine caused them to mutate, or the disease caused them to mutate?
The disease, sorry, but the vaccine had side effects on people. Like the main character's lungs are shot because he was like immunocompromised. So that's why he wears a respirator, because there was some like bad side effects for some people to the vaccine. Yeah.
If the vaccine caused the mutation, I would question SourcePoint publishing it just because it seems a little too.
Yeah.
No, the people there, but
the people that didn't get vaccinated like morphed from the disease. So
yeah. Okay.
But first, Kickstarter, solid book. I love supporting Kickstarter books and being pleasantly surprised with stuff. So
yeah.
Okay, so if anybody had heard me, you're talking about Deathstroke. We got into the Shadow War. So this is Alpha number one. I know, really cheesy name. Williamson was writing it, Bogdanovich on the art. So we find out Ra's al Ghul's sick and dying. It's actually kind of an interesting story. Ra's al Ghul's sick and dying. Damien is there sparring with Talia. Ra's basically wants to turn themselves in because he thinks like, oh, you know, we've tried to change the world, it's not working, so let's turn ourselves in and then let the people use the Lazarus pits for themselves, blah, blah, blah. And he gets assassinated by who everybody thinks to be Deathstroke. And you're like, oh, he got shot in the head, but someone will throw him in the Lazarus pit. He throws a grenade on the body to incinerate the body. So he's like, yeah, you're not Lazarus pitting this time.
Interesting.
It wasn't actual Deathstroke. It was Deathstroke in his older costume. And now Talia showed up to Deathstroke's compound to fight him. And this story is going to continue in the mainstream Batman book. So I don't know how I feel about bringing that all into the mainstream Batman book if they don't make it confusing for people that aren't reading the Deathstroke book. Hopefully it works out.
Like a book I'm sure we're going to talk about later, War for Earth 3.
Yeah. Yeah, War for Earth 3, that'll be my next one.
So,
Robbie,
You left out an important fact about Shadow War.
Yeah.
I didn't read it, but I know this important fact. They brought back a character created during Batman the Animated Series called Lockup.
They did? Oh,
that's what I read. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, Lockup is from Animated Series and is in the book, yes. Yeah. Because there's a
better
whole,
creation.
Yeah, there's a whole Deathstroke scene where he's talking to all his villains and they're all pissed at him for killing Ra's, but he didn't kill Ra's. So War for Earth 3 number 2, Robbie Thompson, Dennis Hopeless, Kieran McGowan, Dexter Vines on the art. So this kind of wraps up everything, and this kind of like ends with Amanda Waller having a new Suicide Squad with Power Woman. Match is now wearing a new Superman suit, Power Ring, and Brainiac Entrigan. Everything before that, I mean, there's a whole lot of teams fighting each other, people fighting each other, Amanda Waller doing the right thing, doing the wrong thing, gets kind of jumbled up, and it tries to catch you up in this book because it probably knows you didn't read the other tie-in books. So there's a lot of catching up, a lot of confusing things going on. There's a lot of like shifting between pages. I don't know why they try to do this in two issues and then shoehorn it into other books. I would just like make it like a 6-issue series, its own thing, and I would have been fine, you know?
So I read all the tie-in books.
Yeah.
There's only 3, but you know, the Flash and the Teen Titans one were worthless. They did not need to happen.
Right.
And I think this book would have been better served as a 4-issue series. Mm-hmm. That being said, I didn't really care for... I'm such a fanboy for the Crime Syndicate.
Right.
That to like make this like pseudo Crime Syndicate that's just an evil Justice League didn't do it for me. Now, we have Dark Crisis around the corner. I'm sure this is going into Dark Crisis. I'm sure we're going to have the Crime Syndicate back in the near future. But it's still just... I didn't care for it.
Yeah.
So, it was unfortunate because I was really looking forward to this crossover.
I do want to see Amanda Waller's new Suicide Squad with the intricate Brainiac and Power Ring and stuff. I think that'll be interesting for someone who reads like, Suicide Squad. But
yeah, I just don't like that it was a bastardized version of the Crime Syndicate. And the Etrigan Brainiac thing, like that's probably the only reason I might check out Suicide Squad, to be honest with you.
It's like, where did that come from? It was just someone's idea to throw it on the page.
It's a cool idea.
Yeah. DC versus Vampire 6, Tinian Rosenberg. Pretty cool issue. They're Batgirl and the Suicide Squad are fighting King Shark vampire version. And they blow up his Amanda Waller blows up his head because he still has the chip in there. She also blows up Boomerang's head because Harley Quinn forgets to tell her that he's not a vampire, which is a pretty funny part of the book. They try to the remainder Batman and the remainder of the heroes try to trap Wonder Woman in her own lasso, and then Alfred comes out and chops off Green Lantern's arm, which is pretty cool. And then Green Arrow kills him and does it for Barry. So like that was a pretty awesome scene. Pretty metal.
It was a heartbreaking scene as well.
Yeah.
Because when he asks, like, is my friend still in there? And he goes, yeah, it's still me and everything. Yeah. And he's just like, well, that makes this so much worse.
Yeah.
Like, oh, God, the feels.
Yeah. That was a pretty great scene. The team that was with Batgirl finds out the head vampire wasn't Joker. And it comes to find out it was Nightwing the whole time, which is a crazy twist. He ends up killing Batman and Jason Todd. So the rest of the Bat family has to escape. Damian was left there, and it looks like they're trying to turn him into a vampire. Alfred and Green Arrow escape in a submarine, but the vampires have won and destroyed most of the cities at the end of the issue. So I thought it was a pretty solid issue. We haven't even seen like Vampire Superman yet, so
I don't know what to expect. I thought it was a great issue.
Yeah, it was.
The twist, I did not see coming that fucking Nightwing was the one.
Yeah.
And it had two really great moments in it with the Green Arrow, Green Lanterns moment. And then once again, when Jason goes back and he's like, I have to try.
Yeah.
And that's when Nightwing gets him and he just says, go ahead and do it, Archer.
Yeah.
And Green Arrow from the submarine shoots him in the heart. And I was like, oh, that's such a great moment.
Yeah. Yeah, Green Arrow had a great, great sequence in that issue.
Yeah. I don't think there's a hiatus on this one. Hopefully there's not, because I really look forward to see where the second act goes.
Yeah, this is great. Tinian's killing it. Batman, One Dark Knight, number 2. Overall, good issue. Batman's still carrying EMP to Blackgate Prison. He tries to, like, map it out some more. We get a little more into, like, EMP had, like, not only had he ruined his son's life, but he ruined another family's life. We find out it's one of the cops that's looking for him. And she actually gets a hold of the son of his son, who we know that has EMP powers. So she's going to use him for something, probably to get back at EMP. And that's kind of like the main overarching story. So we get to see Batman fighting a bunch of thugs with, you know, without power, but with gadgets, stuff like that. So
I like this book, but it's definitely an artist writing it because it's moments it's moments that Jacques wants to draw is what how I feel the book's going, but it's still a really good book.
Swamp Thing 11, Ram V and Mike Perkins in the art. So this is the start of season two. So, you know, this isn't Swamp Thing number one again. This is Swamp Thing number 11. Just letting everyone know. Swamp Thing is supposedly dead. His love interest slash friend Jennifer goes to Tefe Holland, that is the daughter of Alec Holland and Abigail, for help. Mr. Pilgrim, who is like the CEO, the head of Prescott Industries, the awful industry that's like, you know, trying to experiment with all the Swamp Thing shit, is letting Dr. Woodrue, who's like the crazy botanist guy, operate on him and use this petrified corpse they found that belonged to what they thought was the green or the rot. And he's like literally like taking parts of Mr. Pilgrim away of his body and like splicing these like necrotic, like awful, like parts to him. It's really gross. So by the end of it, he wakes up and he's like this half zombie, half monster thing. He looks like he's part of the rot, which is the, you know, the like the blackness, the death of the universe. So that was really cool to see. Tefe does help Jen into the green. The only rationalization she has for that is because she knows she loves Levi, which is pretty cool because it was like she didn't want to get involved with the whole thing, but she still has a connection to the green, which is kind of interesting. When Pilgrim wakes up, it awakens something, and it like it shows like everybody across the universe like feeling it, like a Green Lantern in another universe or another galaxy feels it. And then we get a glimpse of a hero from Stormwatch? I can't remember what he's part of. But anyways, the Jack Hawksmoor. I didn't really know who this character was, but he's called the King of Cities. So what he does is he resides in a city and is like tied to that city. He like feels everything with that city and he can't leave. So he wakes up in Detroit and he says like, oh, something's happening. So there's something bigger is happening. Jack Hawksmoor is tied to it. Don't really know the character. So I'm interested to see where it's going. Rambi has been doing an awesome job with this character. So much so, I mean, they're letting him do a season two. So I think he's really reinvented this whole story. And I'm very interested to see where it goes. A lot of these I know you read too. So I probably let you talk about like Hulk 5, Donny Cates, Ryan Otley. I think a solid fucking issue. Yeah. Just Banner keeps pushing Hulk further and further. And then Betty has taken over. Is that some kind of villain? Maybe you can explain what's going on there.
That's his longtime love interest.
Okay.
Yeah.
They drop a bunch of abomination bombs, like these nukes that are holding abominations in them. That was a pretty cool scene.
Mm-hmm.
The next couple levels of the Hulk meter was like he fights gods. That was pretty cool to see. Just a bunch of Thors.
He fights hell, and then he fights gods.
Yeah. Demons, yeah. Gods, yeah, that was pretty sick. This book's a lot of fun. That's all it is, you know?
Yeah, it was a lot of action. It was, you know, a bunch of fight sequences, but the whole Betty thing in the background was like, I couldn't tell. I feel like it was his subconscious talking to him. It wasn't really the real Betty.
I wasn't and sure then, either.
And then it turned...
And then she kicks him out of the Hulk.
Didn't she say something like it's his father or something? I don't know. It's something to do with the subconsciousness that was going on. But yeah, she kicks him out. So like, I'll be interested to see where that goes. And then they also hint to like, stay tuned to issue 9 for this reveal. And I'm like, okay. I like how cute you're being, but...
Yeah, that's
funny. It's a really good issue.
Iron Fist 2, Alyssa Wong, Michael Yeage on the art. Iron Fist, the new Iron Fist, still looking for the shards of the sword that broke. Danny Rand's still trying to look for the Iron Fist and like trying to figure out how he can get into Kunlun, even though the gate has been sealed. And the new Iron Fist starts to get trained by the Thunderer to channel his ki with a sword. So we found out that there's iron fists that don't just use their fists. There was one that would channel her ki into a bow and arrow, which is pretty sick. And we know he's a sword master, so he's starting to channel into a sword. So, and then his brother shows up, Lin Fang, who seems to be trouble. So a solid issue. I like this iteration of Iron Fist. I'm going to stick with it. Rogue Son number two, Perot and Abel. We find out that his dad is there talking to the Rogue Son. It's his soul. When he died in the suit, his soul was like integrated into the suit. It's kind of interesting. Instead of just saying it's like an AI. He gave him the power over everybody else because he knew there'd be a target on his family. He didn't really know this son, so he has to protect both families and find out who the killer is. And then basically his dad was like, I'll leave you alone if you do that. So he's like, okay, I want you to leave me alone. So and there's a couple scenes where he's trying to learn how to fight and use his powers. Not a bad issue. I know you read Dark Ages number 6, Tom Taylor, Ivan Coelho. That's Everybody Lives Happily Ever After issue.
Yep.
Pretty much. Yeah, they kind of wrap it up pretty quickly. Like, I don't know why, if you're controlling everybody with Kilgrave, why you'd put him on the front lines to get shot in the head. It's kind of a little crazy to me, but
I'll give it up for that Deadpool moment. That was kind of funny. That was a good use of Deadpool.
I didn't know. Yeah, like he gets shot in the head by Deadpool. I was like, I wonder if Chris actually enjoyed that because that was like a nice way to use him, I think, you know?
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, I thought that was good. Yeah, and, you know, they wrap it all up. Like, it's funny because, like, everybody has their own agenda. So, like, Doom has Dracula bite Apocalypse. And they both turn to vampires, so Doom is like, now you're gonna bow to Dracula, and like you'll have to like worship him. And then Blade comes in and cuts both their heads off, which was a sick scene. That was awesome to see.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're both vampires, now I have a reason to kill both of you. So that was pretty awesome to see. I'm always happy to see Blade show up.
I like this issue. I wish he had one more issue because everything felt rushed.
Yeah, it did. I agree.
I feel like halfway through the issue, we finally get Apocalypse's plan.
Right.
And then it's like, oh yeah, so this is his plan. Okay, now we have to stop him. Okay, we got to save everybody. And it's like, boom, 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 boom. Like, just, you should give him one more issue to just kind of let things flow a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But still really good. And I actually liked the ending because it was like an anti-Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Instead of like, because they even said like, there's not a bunch of cannibals and people in leather everywhere. Like,
right.
We created something better, and everybody lives happily ever after.
Yeah, no, it was. I liked the way they ended it. Yeah,
yeah,
it was nice. Radiant Black 13, Higgins and Costa. This is kind of like a filler issue to me. You know, the main character's out of his coma. His friend is shooting commercials with the Radiant Black suit. Doesn't really want to be the hero that he's supposed to be. The villains that have been fighting him, every time he fights those heroes, they power their suits with the black hole suit that he has. So that's like his justification, like, oh, I don't want to get near them and fight them. I like that Higgins still brings up his Cowl book and how there's a movie deal in his universe. Was always a big fan of that book back in the day. Radiant crosses the line and kills one of the villains at the end. So like we see him like, you get to the point where the villain's like, okay, well, you know, you destroy my suit, I'm going to keep coming back and building more suits and hurting more people. So he like slits his throat, and that's how the issue ends. So he crosses that line of killing someone. I think he's going to become like a loose cannon and have to be stopped. So it was an interesting issue. I'm excited to see more. Just hopefully they don't start like keep delaying these issues because I want more to come out, you know? But that's all I had. I have Batman Beyond the White Knight. I want to read it, saved it for last, but then I didn't get around to it, so.
So, you got all my books except for the most important book of the week, which is Batman.
I want to hear it. White Knight. Yeah.
So, it was really great to get back into the White Knight universe, the Murphyverse, if you will. I really enjoyed getting back in there, and it was kind of like a 10 years later thing.
And then
we set up a whole bunch of different things that happened. In that 10 years, you know, Bruce has been in jail. And he's been kind of the not only the model inmate, but he's also been helping like quell things that are happening inside the jail as his way of atoning for what he did as Batman in the previous stuff. And then like the sons of Azrael are in the jail with them, so they call back to that and everything. And then there goes my phone. And then on the outside, we find out that Powers has bought Wayne Enterprises, which is a Batman Beyond thing. And he has this protege who's going to go in to the old Batcave because Bruce made this suit that he didn't tell anybody about and it was too dangerous to use. So he sends his protege in there. And meanwhile, we get kind of a backstory of like what's going on with the GTO and the cops, and there's this whole like, kind of struggle between everybody in Gotham. And then we go back to Powers and his little protege. Well, who would you guess is the protege, Mike? Terry McGinnis, that's right. So, so Terry is the one that goes down into the cave, gets the suit, comes out with a suit, blah, blah, blah. So we get Terry as Batman Beyond. That was a really cool moment. I'll be interested to see how he ties in like Terry working for Powers, because Powers is actually like the main baddie in the Batman Beyond universe. And then the Batman Beyond universe, he's the one that pseudo killed Terry's father. So I'm interested to see how they tie all that in. And then Bruce tries to break out of prison because he knows how powerful the suit is. He doesn't want another Batman out there, blah, 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 blah. We get introduction to Jason Todd, Red Hood. And huge spoilers for the first issue. I'll give everybody a second. When Bruce gets out, he meets up with somebody or runs into somebody who tells him, like, you know, I'm back to finish the job. And it's Jack Napier. He's alive. So it seems like they're not only bringing in the Batman Beyond stuff, they're probably aping the Return of the Joker movie as well. And I just loved every second of it. I love this universe. I love Batman Beyond. So it was, I love that issue. It's great. So I think that's everything I had, Mike. So where can people find you on the internet?
I was muted, but yeah, I'm really excited for that book. And I can't wait. I can't wait to see more of that. I was like chatting along while you're talking, but yeah, so I'm excited. I'm excited for that. And I did say Terry McGinnis too, but I'm interested to see. Do you think like Jack Napier is going to be a full blown villain? You think?
So, I think because they do this cool thing throughout the book too, where characters their shadows show who they really are. So, like, there's one sequence where we see Harley, and her shadow is Harley Quinn. Okay. And then there's one sequence where I left that out too. There's a whole other plot of Harley and her kids because their kids are grown up.
Yep.
But it's really great because that final page is just so phenomenal because it's Bruce and Jack standing there and their shadows are Batman and Joker going against each other. So I do think he's going to pop up as some sort of villain. Like I said, I think they're going to ape the Return of the Joker.
Yeah.
Is what they're going to do.
Cool.
I'm so excited. And also, it also pseudo announced another book because they introduced Red Hood and they say in there like, the Red Hood story to be continued in Batman the White Knight Presents the Red Hood.
Oh, okay. So they're doing like the Harley. They're doing like the Harley Quinn thing with him.
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. So,
awesome. Really excited
for that. Cool.
So, Mike, that's everything. Once again, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at Fortress Ricker on Twitter this time. Where can they find you and or the show?
They can find me at Fortress Chris on Twitter, and they can find the show at Fortress Comics _ on Twitter or at FortressComicNews.com. I remember everybody to look down the show notes. We got the affiliate links as well as the links to our guests this week and where you can find their work. And also, if you want to support the show even further, you got Patreon at patreon.com/FortressComics. If you're a freeloader and want to do something to help the show for free, it's always appreciated to go to the podcatcher of your choice, whether it's Apple, iTunes, Spotify, whatever, and give us a review. Also on YouTube, like, subscribe, share, comment down below, and all that fun stuff. So thank you all so much for listening this week. We will see you all here next week.
See ya.